Hello, everybody, and welcome to a rather special science studio today. We're going to be sort of tracing the record of a great career in science and management of science, and we're going to start way back with the beginning of a career and how that career developed, what were the interesting stories that the rest of us can benefit by hearing. And so we're going to be talking to a special person. So, Russ, who is our special guest today?
We're very happy to welcome to Science Studio Dr. Peter Lucchese. And Peter was the founder of the Exxon Corporate Research Labs, retired now, of course. And that laboratory in its heyday was known as the Bell Labs of Energy. So, Peter, welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Absolutely, sir. What we like to do on this program at the beginning is to sort of learn a little bit about what were the stimulations that the Peter Lucchese, when he was a young boy, had to get into science. And so if you could sort of go through a few of the stories that you remember that really pushed you into a career in science.
Well, what I remember is that I was brought up basically in Little Italy in Manhattan, and we lived in the tenements, but we were very, very tuned to learning. Everybody there went to school. Everybody there passed the test, couldn't wait to become a citizen and all that. And in the end, I got drafted in the Army for a couple of years. When I got out, I went to NYU. And since we had almost no money, but I had been in an accident in the Army, spent 3 months in a hospital, I was entitled to a special benefits under Public Law 16. The GI Bill for me and for people that had some injuries was basically unlimited. You could go to school as long as you wanted. And I walked into New York University. I had no clue what I wanted to do when I got out of the Army. And I started just taking courses. I did that for 7 years, and I got inspired. I make the story a little long because in my own career, it's not that important where you get your degrees. If you are lucky enough to find one, and there's usually only one, maybe two, professors that are really inspirational. I was a man named Seymour Lewin, who had been just graduated from the University of Michigan, was an assistant professor at New York University of Chemistry. He took a liking to me, and he basically nourished me chemistry-wise for the whole 7 years. An absolutely unforgettable, a saintly person, and a wonderful teacher. One of the penalties I had to pay is that he's still alive, actually, Jewish, so that he loved to eat borscht, which was this horrible buttery thing, and stuff I couldn't digest. But since I had to have lunch with him 3 times a week, I had to eat that stuff 3 times a week and make believe it was really good.
Well, what did you do with him? I mean, obviously you worked in his laboratory a little. What sort of work were you doing?
Well, at first, I had to learn some laboratory technique, but by the time I got ready to do my PhD thesis, he wanted to figure out how fast crystals dissolve in water. So he said to me, you know, go out and get some radioactive strontium-90 and make strontium sulfate and figure out how to put it in a stirrer and measure the rate it dissolves in water. But strontium-90 is a little bit dangerous, and we had no money, so we walked out into the Greenwich Village and bought a lot of plastics and constructed a house with two gloves in it, a hood with two gloves in it, and started measuring these rates with radioactive strontium-90. We basically found a new way to look at how crystals dissolve at very, very low concentrations. What makes this story interesting is that, of course, when I graduated, this monstrosity was still right in the middle of the New York University chemistry lab, and it was radioactive as hell. We had, and by the time, as I understand it, it took them years to figure out what to do with it, and they were very glad to get rid of me. By that time, I had moved on, and that thing was there at least 5 to 10 years. Seymour Lewin is still alive. He is retired. He lives in Chicago. And I mention his name maybe more than I should because I want people to remember that no matter what college you go to, there is no substitute for one inspirational person who takes an interest in you.
That's absolutely, absolutely the case.
I have one comment about Cy Lewin. I went to New York, too, and he was still traveling around there. And he had a project where he was using calcium oxalate, I believe, to restore writings on ancient tombstones that had been acid eroded in South America.
Right. And he worked in Italy on some of the statues. He became interested in food chemistry. In fact, one reason probably he never became really famous is that he was interested in too many things and didn't take the time to win any prizes in any of them.
But he had a lot of fun.
Yeah.
So then I
moved on. I went to the Illinois Institute of Technology as an instructor because I thought I might want to be another Seymour Lewin and want to teach chemistry. And that lasted only about a year and a half because I found that I didn't like it and I didn't get any particular thrill out of I just didn't like the thing, besides the fact that they paid instructors a little less than $4,000 a year. There was no way you could live on that, even in the 1950s. And I met, by accident, somebody who was recruiting for Exxon in New Jersey and who said, you know, how would you like to come to SO, in those days it was Standard Oil of New Jersey, and help us figure out a way to use waste radiation, and do some exciting chemistry with it in the oil patch. I took the job immediately, moved to Linden, New Jersey, with my new wife. I had just been married. And there is where we had this fantastic adventure. To this day, I don't know how we got permission to do all this.
Perhaps you didn't.
Maybe we didn't. Somehow or other, we found that you could get a cobalt-60 source. You could actually get one, buy one, rent one. I guess we bought it. And we had the thing, and we drilled a hole in a lot that Exxon owned in Linden, New Jersey, and put this thing down the hole. And then we filled all kinds of test tubes and such, which we periodically used to put down there. And we saw wonderful things. You would put the gas down there if it waited long enough, and you pulled the tube out, you had the liquids. We could convert, actually, methane gas to liquids. It was horribly expensive, we found out later on. But the radiation was so powerful that it basically broke all of the chemical bonds in the hydrocarbon and reconstituted everything. And so you made a mixture of everything, all the way from methane to lubricating oils. We had fantastic nerve because then we decided that we would ask, and Exxon let us do this, encouraged us to do it. We rented a place inside the nuclear reactor at the Brookhaven National Lab. To this day, I can't imagine how that ever happened. In a part of this reaction, we were allowed to put in a flow reactor, an actual piece of steel with instrumentation, and we could do continuous things. You could flow hydrocarbons through this and get the product. We were actually able to do flow-through work in the 1950s, and we did some really good work. The net effect was that there were a lot of interesting things, but they're all horribly expensive. It probably would be horribly expensive now, but not as that expensive. So we were doing this kind of pioneering work way back, and I'm talking about the 60s.
Just going back a moment, though, you start with methane, you irradiate it with cobalt-60 source, yes. And then you get all of the other linear and branched hydrocarbons.
You get a gamish of everything. The reason being that the cobalt-60, the radiation in each bundle of cobalt-60 has got energy at least 100 times more energy in it than you need to break a chemical bond.
Right.
So you break all the bonds that are in what you put in, and then you get back some sort of random product, some of which are really interesting. But we showed the president of Exxon Research that we could make a molecule that had lubricating oil properties from methane. I mean, he was enchanted.
And so, just to be a little technical for a minute, you did this under an environment of nitrogen and get hydrocarbons, yes. And if you do it in oxygen, you get oxygenated materials.
You could get oxygenated materials. You could do, if you did it with solids, you could react the surface of the solid and change the chemistry, although we were never able to change the chemistry in any really truly interesting way. But in the end, that's really the way it turned out. You could do fascinating things, but from the point of view of chemistry, what's going on there is really far too delicate to study with a probe that's like hitting a peanut with a sledgehammer.
And altogether just too expensive.
So
no money to be made.
Probably expensive.
Right. Well, anyway, so after those fascinating experiments, and I'm sure you wrote lots of reports and maybe even a few patents, what did you do next?
Well, then I guess the management at Exxon Research was sort of impressed, and I got involved with a group there called the Process Research Division, doing chemistry, trying to find ways to really improve refinery processes. That was an exploratory job, and it was truly interesting. It was my first exposure to the petroleum industry and how they really worked, at least in the refining area, because I found that they were absolutely superb engineers. I don't know, I'll tell you an anecdote about Exxon, which is going to be bragging a little bit, but it isn't generally known, and I may be exaggerating, but not by much. The petroleum people are fantastic engineers, and they are great chemical engineers. In the war, a man named Professor Lewis from MIT found really a new way to make catalysts really much more effective, which he called the fluidized bed. In a fluidized bed, you take these catalysts, you make a powder out of them, and then you fluidize them by passing the gas through them, and you increase the contact time enormously. And Doc Lewis went to Exxon, then Esso, and said, you know, this thing could vastly improve the efficiency of making jet fuel, which was the time during which the Germans were beating the devil out of the British with their Spitfires, which I don't remember all the details, but they were much more agile. They could go to much higher altitudes more quickly, and they had made better jet fuel, although they made it very expensively from coal. In any case, to make a very long story short, it was Doc Lewis at MIT and the SO people at Baton Rouge, Louisiana, who built in almost no time, not a pilot plant, but a commercial plant, a plant big enough to produce jet fuel, which they did, and God only knows how they managed to do it, because the U.S. got it to England, and it was used by the British in the Battle of Britain, and it made a major contribution in winning, in fact, the air battle of Britain against the Messerschmitts.
That was in 1940, so this
that
research...
That would have been in 1940, right?
Right, that was very early on, so the
that
actual
was very
research...
very early on, and it's a digression from my story, but I did want to make the point that what I found... when I joined the laboratory, is that they were fantastic engineers, very heavily oriented toward chemical engineering. They did not know very much about sort of the basic chemistry involved in a in a refining process, like catalytic reforming, which is used, to, of course, to make gasoline.
Well, let me just come full circle on that, because now in Kent, in the southeast of England, where a lot of the Battle of Britain aerial dogfights occurred, they now make a bitter. It's called Spitfire, and it's brewed in Faversham. And their advertising campaign is Spitfire, downed all over Kent. And then in parenthesis, just like the Luftwaffe. You're listening to Science Studio.
I'll be done.
Keith Pannell, Russ Kinelli, Peter Lucchese, and we'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Niesel. The number one priority to treating injuries on the battlefield is to stop the bleeding. But that's challenging when wounds penetrate deep into the body.
Of the 5,800 Americans killed in battle since 2001, the vast majority died from hemorrhages that were potentially survivable. So the Army is now testing a new tool called X-STAT, which uses a pocket-sized injector to send 92 sponges into a wound, stopping bleeding in 15 seconds.
It serves up two essential elements, pressure and clotting. X-STAT uses tiny, disc-shaped sponges made of sterile cellulose and coated with chitosan, a clotting agent.
The sponges expand from just 3 millimeters thick to 50 millimeters when they're in contact with blood. This speeds up clotting, and equally as important, it puts pressure on the blood vessels to slow bleeding.
Field medics now use field dressings or tourniquets, but with mixed results. They work well for surface wounds, but not for deep penetrating wounds when the medic needs to pack in gauze and hold it until the bleeding stops.
But with X-STAT, the medic could inject the sponges into the wound and treat somebody else. Since the sponges clump together, they can be easily removed later. And just to be sure, they're also labeled with an X that can easily be spotted by X-ray.
One X-STAT injection of sponges is equal to 5 rolls of combat gauze, yet take up less space in a medic's pack. The company developing it is also working on a smaller version to inject sponges into more narrow wounds caused by shrapnel, handguns, or knives.
This would save thousands of lives on the battlefield, but I wouldn't be surprised if they eventually show up in an EMT's arsenal.
We are Drs. David Niesel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Russ Kinelli, and our guest, Peter Lucchese.
Peter was the founder of the Exxon Corporate Research Lab, and that laboratory in its heyday was known as the Bell Labs of Energy.
And Peter, we got as far as your interesting exploits from getting into the refinery activities of Exxon, or Esso as it then was. What was your major responsibility when you got into that refinery type of group?
We were a very early group in Exxon. Our major responsibility really was to do exploratory work. We did not call it fundamental or basic or anything like that. We called it exploratory because of the feeling that somehow or other you might be able to improve existing refinery processes. And so we were given a certain amount of freedom to explore around. We had some consultants with us who were very, very helpful. And among other things, this radiation project I talked about was a part of that group. But more importantly, we began to study in a very preliminary way processes that, for example, how is it that in cracking, we were trying to figure out what these catalysts are, acidic, and we were trying to figure out how that helps you make gasoline from these sort of worthless feeds. And so we were doing what is now sounds like very primitive work on the basic intermediates, the carbonium ions, and we made some contributions. But we were never more than a group of about 10 or 20 people. We didn't get very far doing that. In the end, that group was then absorbed into another group, which was called the Central Basic Research Laboratory in Exxon, and that became really the first glimpse of what then became corporate research, a systematic attempt to exploit chemistry and physics and the fundamental things again, inspired by, partly inspired at least, I think, by the relationship between the then president of MIT and the then CEO of ESSO, who was Cliff Garvin, who was behind the scenes, always urging the company to get more involved with science and understanding.
And also, I mean, from the way you put it, it was clear at the beginning then, you were saying chemists and physicists, engineers, the concept of multidisciplinary approaches to the problems was the key in later success.
Yes, later. At the beginning, you know, it was just a word that people didn't really understand. As I say, they were very good at taking somebody else's basic stuff and doing a lot of wonderful engineering. An amusing thing that happened somewhat later on is the what we call the food from oil. I don't want to know if you want to talk about that.
Go on ahead. Yes, absolutely.
Well, there was a feeling in the oil patch and in Exxon that really and truly we were likely to run out of oil. And besides, we were having, I guess, a lot of trouble finding all these giant fields that we wanted to find. And again, they then commissioned a study to try to develop new uses for oil. I think that
we're talking about 1960 or something.
We're talking now about the late 60s, the mid to late 60s.
When oil was how much a barrel? $10 or something
like
that?
Yeah, $10. It was not a lot, and there was no hope that although there was a feeling that we would run out, the feeling was that even so, you couldn't count on that. And so we decided, I was part of that, we decided that, among other things, we would try to make food from oil, believe it or not. And the inspiration came from a scientist. His name was John Duros, who was a microbiologist, and who said, you know, what you can do with this stuff is that you could take methane and you could feed it to these bacteria, and the bacteria might eat it and grow fat and all that, and then you can kill the bacteria, and you have created soy, or because they're full of molecules. We didn't really know what they were full of, and So we actually did that. We began to screen bacteria and organisms of all kinds and feed them hydrocarbons. And we did find one, I don't know what it was called, Pseudomonas something or other. And they loved it. They ingested this thing. They grew, they multiplied, and what they produced, when they were through and you cultivated them and you destroyed them, it was a kind of a thing that looked just like gorgonzola cheese. And it smelled like it, too. It smelled like cheese. And it had these black spots in it that we didn't know what they were. The fearsome thing about that is that we didn't have a single biologist except John Duros, who, as I say, was a microbiologist, but he hadn't really done any of this stuff. So we began to show off this stuff. We invited all kinds of people in management of Exxon.
You had little biscuits and white wine with this, or what?
We passed around this gunk and said, look, but we had instructed John Duros to be sure that he had developed a technique for destroying the bacteria so that if it got in anybody's hands, they wouldn't just eat it. And so he said, well, I have developed, it is foolproof, 100% lethal, so we have no live bacteria. To make a very long story short, I will not give you his name, but we actually made presentations to the management at all levels of ESSO, and at least two of them couldn't resist the temptation to stick their finger in the jar and take a lick of this stuff, you see. We found out about 2 months later that John Duros' method for killing the bacteria was full of holes.
Just like the cheese.
That, in fact, there were live bacteria in this thing. Maybe not many, but there certainly were some. And we then terminated that project pretty fast. John DeRosa, two other things. But we were able to make a substitute for soy from methane, and just like the radiation, it was horribly expensive and a little dangerous, but in case we ever get to that case again, it can be done. That was a scary period of life, because we learned then that we were much too arrogant in what we were doing with that period.
Well, let's talk about that, because obviously that period of time you're talking about, you were an active scientist, but later you became the director of that corporate research.
And built the laboratory.
And, yes. How did that transition? How did you go from then being an active person doing the work in the laboratory and talking about it to, in fact, then heading it up and setting up the corporate research?
One of my mentors at a large corporation, you wind up with some people, relatively few, who think you're great, and quite a bit more who think you're not so great. And, one of the people who thought I was great, wherever he went, and he was rapidly getting, his name was Don Bader, another wonderful person who took me wherever he went, and he kept getting promoted. He wound up the head of what we then called the Basic Research Laboratory. We had centralized at SOD Basic Research, and it was called the Basic Research Laboratory. It had about 30 or 40 scientists there who were doing pretty far-out work. Don Bader became the head of that, and so he brought me in as his assistant. I got to enjoy that thing. I remember somebody making the analogy to me, which I've always found to be very useful. You have to understand in science, whether you want to be, say, the most expert violinist in the orchestra, or whether you want to be the conductor, whether you get a kick from one or the other. I've always thought that was a very good analogy, because I found then in my first stab at trying to manage, these were 40 scientists and maybe 40 assistants, I found then that, in fact, as far as being a scientist, I could be pretty good, but I could never be the first violinist in a major orchestra. I had no chance of being that good. But I was a pretty good conductor. In other words, I could ask enough questions so that I could truly get people interested in the questions, and maybe going to another person they knew and saying, you know, here's a way of looking at things. And whenever that happened, I got an enormous kick out of that. And so I decided that if I could, I would like to stay doing that.
So then, Peter, I think what we will do is we'll end this program on that particular note. You had a lot more to offer as the organizer, as the conductor, than as an individual player. But however, we'll come back next week and do a second program with your experiences as the head of the Central Research.
Well, it was very interesting having Dr. Peter Lucchese with us. And next week we will have Peter back for another show to tell us more about the stories, including how he hired some famous rock stars from the 60s in his labs.
Can't wait to hear it. Norma Martinez, thank you for putting the program together. Thank you out there for listening, and we will be back next week with another Science Studio. Bye-bye.